the Water Center for inviting me to speak today. And Water First, we're a Seattle-based organization, so we're really happy to have relationships with people on the University of Washington campus, especially with a focus here on international public health issues, and especially as they relate to water and sanitation. To start today, I just want to tell you a little bit about the motivation for our work. We're involved in helping people with their water and sanitation issues because it's a very huge public health crisis in the developing world. About a billion people on Earth don't have access to clean water. 2.4 billion people don't have access to latrines, and this results in the deaths of about, there are different estimates, anywhere from 2 to 5 million people each year. It's also estimated that today, like every day, about 5,000 children will die from diarrheal illnesses related to water and sanitation. And it's responsible for about 80% of the illnesses in the world, too. About 80% of the illnesses that are caused in the world are directly related to the lack of access to clean water and sanitation. The water and sanitation crisis also has a really devastating effect on women and girls who spend their time carrying water. I've met many, many women, too many women in Africa, who are spending half their day, 10 hours, 12 hours, simply in the task of water collection. And for young girls in poor countries, I can tell you that there's a straight trade-off between the time that they spend walking to get water and the time that they could be spending in school. Women obviously could be spending their time better also, working more productive jobs like agriculture or something that pays them a salary, or I think they'd be better off if they had more time to rest. So I see women working very hard. And in addition to the task of carrying water, women are also burdened with caring for sick kids, caring for sick relatives, and all the other really hard work in the household, preparing food and taking care of livestock. There's also an economic issue related to the water crisis, especially in urban areas of developing countries. A lot of people, poor people, are paying for water. They're not connected to the public water supply system because they're living in squatter settlements where they don't have legal access to the land that they're living on, so they have no legal water supply. And you can't live without water, so what do? They buy it from water vendors. And water vendors are happy to take advantage of the situation and charge what they can get away with charging for water. Studies have been done on this to see what people are paying for water, and it ranges anywhere from comparing it to what people who are legally connected to a water supply pay, so the middle class and upper class who do have legal connections. And what they found is that in Jakarta, Indonesia, for example, the poor are paying 60 times what people with legal connections to the water supply are paying. In Karachi, Pakistan, it's 83 times. And in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, it's 100 times. So the poorest of the poor in these cities are paying 60 to 100 times more what middle and wealthy residents of the same city are paying for the same water. I also want to talk a little bit about water and poverty, because there's lots of different approaches that people are taking to this problem. And we try to make our approach with the end result of having an impact on poverty. And so I want to talk a little bit about the relationship between water and poverty, because it's not just about the health impact that we're seeking to address. You know, I did mention the health impact, and so I won't repeat that other than to say that, you know, when you think about young kids who are repeatedly having diarrheal illnesses, this has an impact on their growth and development, their ability to learn. I also frequently see kids who have been left alone at home while mom is off collecting water, getting injuries in the household, you know, running into the cooking fire or having other kinds of accidents. So it has a definite impact on health. It also has an impact on household income, because people are either paying for water or women are off collecting water when they could be using their time more productively. As I mentioned before, it has an impact on education. Young girls often help their moms go collect water, and so that means that they're not in school. When girls aren't going to school, that means that they're not literate, and it's not surprising that the lack of education has an impact on the population of a country as a whole. And the countries with the least educated people are the poorest. And I also see an impact just in terms of leadership of women. You know, when women can't read, they don't become leaders in communities. So this leads into the next point, which is gender equality. I think if we're going to end poverty in this world, we have to be addressing gender equality issues. And if there ever was a gender equality issue, it's water. Women are the mules of the world carrying water to and from their houses. The water and sanitation crisis also has an environmental component. You know, the poor of the world are very dependent upon their environments in order to survive. They're subsistence farmers, so they need good soil. They need trees to maintain that soil. They're subsistence fishermen who are reliant on the quality of water supplies. And often these poor people have very little control over the environment, even though they're completely dependent on it. So when you talk about sustainability of water supplies, I think you're directly talking about the environment and the environment that poor people rely on for their very survival. You know, one other thing I wanted to mention, there's a lot of talk in the international development world these days about the Millennium Development Goals. You might have heard them called the MDGs. And every time I hear that, I just think of MGD, which in my civil engineering background meant million gallons per day. And also my civil engineering background meant Miller Genuine Draft, which is what we always had in a keg at our civil engineering party. So it's MDG, and the largest gathering of world leaders in all history met, I believe, in the year 2000, and they set the Millennium Development Goals with the idea of ending poverty. And water and sanitation were directly addressed in the environmental sustainability goal. And the goal is to they have strange language about it, but it's basically 50%. We want to get to the 50% level for people with access to water and sanitation. Why it's not 100%, I don't know. But I was disappointed that they didn't go further to set a 100% goal, but it's by 2015, we only want to have half of the world's poor who lack access to safe water and latrines. But what I found is that it's not just about the environmental sustainability goal. There are other goals related to poverty that I talked about, gender equality, girls' education. And so I have a sheet, if you're interested in getting a copy of it, it's also on our website, that talks about the direct and indirect link of water to all of the Millennium Development Goals. So you can see I'm pretty into water. It's being an important piece to ending poverty. Another reason that that we exist and do projects the way we do is because water projects are pretty notorious for failure. And not a lot of work has been done to study this, but there's a lot of anecdotal evidence out there that says that basically about 50% of water projects that are implemented fail for one reason or another in the first 2 to 3 years that they're implemented. And if you talk with anybody who's working in the field, they'll use that number, and they'll say that water project failures are definitely an issue. And anybody who's been to India sees the landscape littered with broken down hand pumps. And you know, there are a lot of reasons that water projects fail, but there are ways to respond so that this doesn't have to happen. Projects are failing because people are using inappropriate technology, because of political problems in the country, but the reason that I see most frequently that projects are failing is because there's a lack of local leadership and ownership of a water project in a community. people simply don't know how or don't have the leadership and administrative structure in a community so that they can maintain a project on their own. And, you know, we can't, as an organization or any other development organizations, can't continually be coming into communities and operating and maintaining it for them over time. They have to be able to do it on their own, and that's the piece that is often missing in projects. So I just want to talk about, you know, what I see making projects sustainable and what goes into a sustainable project. And our approach is that, first of all, we only work through what we call our locally based partner organizations. And these are NGOs that are based in the countries where we work. So in Honduras, we have a Honduran organization. In India, we work with an Indian organization. They're staffed by local professionals who have a unique understanding of the social and political and cultural infrastructure that exists in villages. They have the trust of the communities because the staffs of our partner organizations are often from the very areas where we're trying to do work. So it's not people coming from the outside, it's people from that area trying to help improve the situation there. So, you know, when you're talking about making changes in people's behaviors and trying to set up a structure in a community so that they can maintain projects over the long term, we really need to have that trust and understanding between beneficiary communities and the partner. So that's why we work in the way that we do. And we put a lot of effort into the selection of that locally based partner organization. So when we're moving to a new area, we have funding and we're able to move on, we put a lot of work into identifying a local partner that has a proven track record of implementing sustainable projects, projects that aren't going to fail with communities. So we're looking at their old projects and we're actually making visits to projects that are 5 or 10 years old and interviewing water committees and feeling comfortable that this organization is going to be able to continue to produce the same successful results. And I think if anything separates us from other organizations out there doing that work, it's that point right there, that we actually go into the field and we actually visit old projects. There are not a lot of organizations that are doing that, doing it very actively. Another piece that goes into our projects is commitment on the part of the communities where the projects are being implemented. Communities, I believe, have to be involved in every single step of the planning and the implementing and the financing of their projects. These might be communities where the highest education level is 6th grade, but these are very smart and resourceful people, and they're in so many ways just like us. I mean, you've probably all been involved in an organization where a decision was made and you felt like you needed to be part of the discussion of that decision, but it was made without your input, and so you don't want to be part of it anymore. And I think that's human nature. People are the same all over the world. They don't want decisions made for them. They want to be informed and be part of that decision-making process. So the partner organizations that we're working with are really great at working with communities to give them all the information they need and help them get through a decision-making process. I've been in communities in rural Bangladesh where they were having to install arsenic treatment technologies, and I've heard rural poor villagers from Bangladesh explain to me the 3 different types of treatment technologies that were options for them and why a particular one was chosen for them. So people are very smart and they want to be part of these decisions, and they don't like it when people from the outside tell them what to do. The other way that that communities are committed to projects is obviously they have to learn how to maintain the projects over the long term. So our partner organizations are training plumbers from the community to make repairs that are needed and setting up that whole infrastructure, making sure that they know where to get spare parts, that there's a whole system that's built around identifying the issue with the project, whether it be a pipeline project or a hand pump project, that the plumbers know how to find the problem and fix it and where to buy the spare parts, and that the community has a system of collecting funds so that there's money available to buy those spare parts. Oftentimes, this system of collection is a monthly tariff that every household pays, and so when there's and this is paid every month, no matter if the water system is working or not, because it usually doesn't work to wait for the system to break and then take that extra time to go collect money. It's better to have it in an account and ready to go, because you never know when the water system might need to be repaired. We also like for communities to make, in addition to paying for the maintenance of projects, we like for them to make a contribution to the capital cost of the project itself, the upfront cost. And this might be 1% of the project cost or 100%, but we feel like poor people, even very poor people, can pay something. And I find that they actually want to pay something. And so we structure that they can either take a loan out, they can pay it completely upfront, and depending on the economy of the communities that we're working with, our partner organizations set the level of a financial commitment. So in all of our projects, people are paying something in cash for the implementation of the project. Our projects are also what I call integrated, and what I mean by that is it's not just water. It's water and sanitation and hygiene education. If you want to have an impact on health and thus impact poverty, you really need to do all three. And they need to be done in combination with one another. You know, it's fine to go and teach people about hygiene education and the importance of washing hands, but if they don't have more water in order to do that, they're not going to be able to make those kinds of behavior changes. So our partner organizations often train local women as village hygiene what are called village hygiene communicators or hygiene promoters, who then talk with individual households and encourage people to make behavior changes that will have an impact on their health. So it's a lot of hand washing after using the latrine, before preparing food, making sure you actually do use your latrine, keeping food covered, how to store and treat your household water. All of these things are included in a hygiene education component. And our projects are also always focused on increasing access to water. We want to eliminate the walk that women are making to get water. Our projects use appropriate technology, so we're not going to put in a project where you can't buy the spare parts and where communities cannot afford to maintain it. You're looking for failure if you do something like that. There's also a water source protection component, so that the water sources will be sustained over time, so that people aren't over pumping, that they're not cutting down too many trees, so that the springs won't be able to replenish. All of those things are incorporated by our partner organization. And communities then will actually take action based on what they learn, replanting trees in parts of the watershed that have been denuded, or other activities that can protect the water source. And finally, involvement of women. It's really, because women are some of the biggest beneficiaries of these projects, they're no longer having to walk to get water. If you want a sustainable project, it's really important to involve women. If a woman is on the water committee, there's no way that water pump is going to be broken for very long. She doesn't want to go back to her old life of having to walk 10 hours to collect water. So we're not trying to change the culture of these communities. We just recognize that for the sustainability of the project, women need to be involved. And our partner organizations are very aware that this change might be uncomfortable for some members of the community, because women are going to have, over time, higher status in the community and more respect. And so they work really carefully with the community so that everyone is supportive of women being involved at the level that they are. And I think that is all of the background. Yeah, now what I want to do is show you a 10-minute film that demonstrates all of these concepts. This is a film that we made of our projects in Dhaka, Bangladesh. Dhaka is the capital city of Bangladesh, And our projects there are with urban settlements. So these are poor people that are squatting on land that they don't own. And so this film will just talk about the water supply and sanitation problems that they face, and also the solutions that our local partner organization in Bangladesh is working with the community to implement. So 10 minutes, and I'll be back up.
Okay.
My name is Radha. I am 40 years old. My parents and my 10 sisters and brothers moved here from the southern part of Bangladesh 20 years ago. My father could not find work in our rural village of Borishahr, so we moved here.
Rabia lives in Demra slum. Demra is a squatter settlement outside the service area of the Dhaka Public Water Utility. Therefore, residents of the community rely on extremely polluted water sources.
We have no choice but to collect water from the river. I know it is very dirty. Sometimes there are dead dogs and cattle floating in it, and also human feces. We get sick from this water. Sometimes people die from the water. At least we think it's the water. We don't know for sure because we are not educated, but the doctor says it's the water.
Bangladesh is one of the world's most densely populated countries, which puts a tremendous strain on available safe drinking water sources. Access to latrines is equally critical to controlling disease. Demra is home to about 100,000 people, most of whom do not have access to safe water sources, and they also don't have access to safe sanitation. These are a row of hanging latrines, which are called that because they deposit waste directly into open waterways. These waterways then flow to the community's drinking water sources. At Water First, we believe that access to safe water is the most basic human right. Water and sanitation projects are essential for the health and dignity of poor people. Our support is provided in a unique way, through our network of locally based and locally staffed partner organizations that each have a proven track record of implementing sustainable water projects.
We started working in Dhaka slums in the mid-80s. We were a group of professionals and young people who wanted to do something. So we thought, okay, it is better to start with a healthcare project. In a sense, I'm a medical doctor, so we went out to the slums and started providing some treatment to people. One day some people came to me appreciating what we were doing, but they flagged their problem of water with us, that we are living in slums and there is no water. We cannot access legal water supply.
When I travel to developing countries and I meet with the doctors that are working with impoverished people,
They tell me time and time again that 80% of the illnesses they are seeing could be prevented if the population simply had access to safe water and latrines.
We're here in the Mirpur slum with the Operation and Maintenance Committee for Mirpur Slum's Water and Sanitation Project. This is a committee made up of 9 members, all women. These women have been describing for us the training that they received from our local partner organization. They received training in collecting funds, hygiene education, how to keep the water system clean, and how to keep the latrines clean. And through that training, they've been able to administer this project and keep the water points working every day.
To ensure the sustainability of our projects, the communities we support are involved in every step of the planning, implementing, and financing of their projects.
This is Lily, and she's the cashier for the Water Point Committee. And this is the book where they are recording their loan payments.
Women are mostly engaged with water because of domestic purposes. And they are the managers who go and fetch water from water points, come back, and use water for all other household business. So in that sense, in all our projects, we rely on women organization, women community-based organization in that specific slum or in that village to manage the water projects.
Having an important public role as a hygiene promoter or water committee member enhances the women's skills in the community, gives them more confidence, and ultimately makes them stronger and more respected community members. This change is not always welcomed by everyone in the community. Our local partner organizations are aware of this and work carefully with the community to explain the importance of women's involvement to the success of the project. I'm a member of the Water Point Management Committee. Every month, our group is responsible for cleaning the pump and tightening the bowls. Monthly, we collect funds from the households needed to pay for operating the water point. We also clean the latrines weekly. We are volunteers and hard workers. We are proud to work for the development of our community.
The projects supported by Water First include 3 components: water, sanitation, and hygiene education. If we want to have an impact on health, sanitation and hygiene education must accompany the water infrastructure. Many illnesses, especially in young children, are caused by unsafe hygiene practices, such as not washing hands after using latrines. Hygiene promoters from our local partner organization talk to community members about hygiene practices that help prevent the spread of disease.
Before the project, the people collected water from the rivers and used hanging latrines. So after we installed a well and pit latrines, everyone used the new facilities. But these people had never used a latrine before. We explained to them how to wash their bodies and wash their hands after latrine use, how to cover their food to keep the flies off.
These are the new latrines. They're constructed by digging a pit, and the pit is lined with 5 concrete rings so that the human waste will no longer go into the waterways.
The hygiene educators understand that if the goal of their work is to affect behavior change, the changes must be the decision of the communities and individuals involved. Since we drilled the new well, our children are healthier. We don't have to make any more trips to the doctor. We find that we are now saving money because we don't have to pay for medicines from the doctor. We're using that money to buy other things for our children, like food, clothes, and school books.
I also want to say to you how much I admire the work that you're doing. You know, in the United States, we're very lucky. We don't know what it's like to live in a slum. We don't know what it's like to have to spend our days collecting water. And so I'm humbled by women who maintain their spirits, maintain their faith, in order to come together and do projects like this that improve the health and the life of your community.
Yeah, so, I mean, hopefully the film captures it. I think it captures it well, that really what we see as the keys to project success are, one, doing projects with communities and not for them. Number two, that we're building the capacity of communities so that it can meet its own needs in the future. That's really one of our goals. And then this integrated approach with water and sanitation and hygiene education that is addressing all these key components. It's all right if you don't get it working.
Okay.
And the other point I want to make is that I really see this as it's more than just water to me. You know, these projects are really comprehensive. You know, we're talking to people about environmental components with water source protection. You know, obviously there are the gender issues that are involved. Because of that, I see the benefits. I mean, this is what keeps me coming back to water and why we named this organization Water First. Because people in developing countries have many, many needs. I mean, no doubt, there are lots of things that we need to work on to really end poverty. And what I see is that the benefits of water projects just go beyond the basic health issues and really build this nice foundation so that you can actually do other projects. I've talked with people who have tried to implement microcredit projects, and I love microcredit projects, you know, helping women start small businesses, but they find that they're more successful in communities that already have water, because women have more time to put into their small businesses if they're not off collecting water. So, you know, I'd say we've got to work on all these different development projects, but we really need to focus a lot on getting everybody access to water, because I think it's going to make the follow-up projects more successful. And I've seen that. I've seen successful water projects be the springboard for other community water projects. And I've seen communities themselves take that initiative where they weren't before. And what I think is happening is that communities have, for so long, they haven't had water, and they really can't imagine a day when they will have water. And so when it happens, when the 10-hour walk ends and they have this water project that they've built themselves, that they're managing themselves, there's a shift in what they think is possible or not possible. And because this thing that they thought wasn't possible now is, so why are we limiting ourselves? So I see communities take on projects where they've built schools, they've built roads to get to their community, they've worked to get electricity into the community. So they on their own have started addressing the other basic needs in the community on the base of a successful water project. So that's what keeps me in this, because I really see it as a foundation for real change in communities. So, you know, in addition to talking to what goes into sustainable water projects, I just want people to be excited about the idea that I do think it's possible to end poverty in our world. I see a lot of hope out there in the midst of all of the problems of the world, because I see these changes happening. So, with that, open it up to questions, right? We have time for questions. Okay. Anybody? Yeah.
In the video that we saw, the community that was slaughtered,
That's a good question. I don't know if you heard it. She's asking about, because we're working in these squatter settlements in Dhaka, Bangladesh, how are the legal issues with the water supply dealt with? It took our partner organization that is working there 10 years to work out an agreement with the Dhaka Water and Sewer Authority and the Dhaka City Commission, which are the two entities that need to give permission. And it was 10 years of building a relationship with them and convincing them that it was really in their best interest to allow this to happen, because people were getting water. They were getting it illegally from vendors who were illegally tapping the public water system and then reselling the water to these residents. So this is unaccounted for water that the water utility is getting no revenue from. So by setting up this legal water connection, you know, it's actually in the interest of the utility, because all of a sudden they're going to start collecting revenue that they weren't collecting before. So that was a lot of the basis of this 10 years of negotiation. But these are legal. They have permission. It just took a long time to convince them that that was a good thing to do. And now I think, and every time donors come, like me, when we come visit Dhaka, we have to go meet with the commissioners of the local water utility, just to keep encouraging them to do that. That helps maintain the relationship also. Now I think they, because of all the recognition that they're getting from the donor community, they're feeling good that it's the right humanitarian thing to do, as well as increasing the revenue of the utility. So it's a good question. Yeah.
What is the construction of these things, and what kind of equipment do you use?
It varies. In our projects in Honduras, nearly 100%. There's a few things that are done by skilled masons, but most of the work is done by the communities themselves. So there's technicians group that are from our partner organization that organize the work crews. In places like India and Bangladesh, and sometimes in Ethiopia, if there's ever a well to be drilled, then a drilling contractor is hired. And it could be anywhere from a big drilling rig, like you might see here, that comes in and drills a well, but more commonly it's a hand bored well. So you'll see this group of about four guys who were hand boring. And I don't know how else to explain it, but there's, you know, kind of a pole with an auger on the end, and people walk in a circle and drill a well. And I've seen hand bored wells go down to 1,000 feet. Yeah. So we try to do projects as cheaply as possible, and whenever possible use labor in the communities themselves. It's if they participate in construction, that again demonstrates their commitment to the project, but also sets them up for being able to make repairs. If they were part of building it, then they're going to be able to repair it in the future. So, yeah, in the back. Okay. Well, Water First is new. We've been around for about 2 years now, so I can speak to what Water First has done in 2 years. We're in the process of installing, we've made commitments to install about 140 different water points over the next 3 years in Dhaka, and each of those water points serves, a little over 100 people, between 100 and 150 people. So somebody do the math. And the cost per water point is, I know a cost per person. It's about $10 a person to do the projects in Dhaka. I can't think of, our budgets are based on water and sanitation and hygiene education, so I'm not pulling out the number for the well itself, but all together with all, so $10 a person for the entire project, including all three components. So it's not expensive. And our costs vary. Dhaka and our projects in India are the cheapest projects we do per person, because these are public water points. They involve the hand augering, which is much cheaper than a drill rig. Our projects in Honduras can be as high as $100 a person, because we're it involves a lot of PVC pipe to get the water from far off locations down into communities. drilling a public water point really isn't an option in the area that we're working in Honduras, because households are so spread out that a public water point wouldn't really help people reduce their walking time to get water. Yeah?
Like going forward in the future, it's like think about our society where we all have access to water, a lot of it's blind, bottled water.
Mm-hmm.
Have you, if you encounter an environment where, you know, maybe the water source is polluted, would you, I mean, it sounds to me like you're creating water sources on site.
Mm-hmm.
Is bottled water an option that kind of gets into that whole,
Like, would we be supportive of a project that supplied bottled water to people, or is that, I'm just trying to understand your question.
Yeah, that was part of the solution, and also maybe how, global warming, how that might impact
mm-hmm.
water sources going forward.
Well, I think, I mean, without getting into the environmental issues of all of the waste plastic from bottled water, I'd say that we're trying to go for the cheapest solution for communities so that they can afford to maintain things. So if we're ever involved in trucking in bottled water or really extensive treatment, I mean, the reason that we tend to do projects that are tapping into an already clean water source like groundwater is because it's just cheaper to do. It's cheaper to build up front, and it's really, really cheaper to maintain because you're not constantly treating water. So it's hard for me to imagine that we would ever employ that as a solution because it would just be so expensive. I think if we were ever in a situation where we just couldn't find a clean water source, we would look into options where it's a community-level treatment technology, because I think that would be more efficient and, you know, more cost-effective. Yeah.
What's the kind of lead time for a project, like the front end time that goes into research and looking at your sort of partner organizations, sort of previous history, and then setting up the project?
Well, right now we're working with four partners, and our model is we stay committed to our partners. So we're going to be, as long as those partners are working, continuing to implement sustainable projects, we're going to keep funding them.
Mm-hmm.
So, and different donors work different ways. Donors in the international, all kinds of international projects tend to move around a lot. So we're purposely different. We think that doesn't work with water projects because we want our partners to be sustainable. So we just keep funding them year after year. So on an annual basis, we're not in a process of continually searching for new partners. We're sticking with the ones they have until they reach their capacity, and then we'll move on. Now, to find new partner organizations, like for instance, when we found the one in India, it was about a year-long process of from the very beginning of sending out inquiries to, you know, actually selecting a partner. And then project, I don't know if your question is also how long does it take to implement projects with
project.
Them, too. That also varies. There's a lot of time spent up front in communities, working on the organizational structure within a community so that they can manage the project in the end. So that part is done before construction. So before the first shovel hits the ground, there's already a water committee set up that is basically going to be the service of public water utility in the future. So that upfront time is anywhere from 3 to 6 months in our communities. And then the construction after that varies depending on whether we're hand augering or digging miles and miles of pipeline trench. So the construction after that can be anywhere from 3 months to 2 years, depending on how big the project is. So is that, get it? All right, who am I? Yeah.
At the beginning of, when you talk about when you first engage with a community,
mm-hmm.
and you're looking for, there's like a community governance structure, or sometimes I guess you kind of create a community governance structure.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering, what's your criteria for what you're looking for, that a community is ready to create that structure, mm-hmm. or has a structure that will function?
Mm-hmm.
I guess, and the flip side of the question would be, what are the red flags and kind of
Yeah, and that's all. I mean, just, you know, that's stuff that our local partner organizations are doing. You know, they're making that decision of which communities are ready for a project and which ones aren't. As far as the governance structure, like you said, communities are at all different places. There typically is, before a project, you know, some sort of organizational structure in the community. There are, you know, religious leaders or, you know, wealthier landowners who might be respected people in the community. So there's already something that exists. So these projects always have to fit into that. Our partner organizations are just, I'd say red flags would be if these more powerful people aren't allowing sort of a represent, you know, for whatever reason, that there's not a representative cross-section of the community being involved. And our partner organization staff sort of infiltrate the community and get to know all the different people in the community so that they can learn who, if anything unhealthy is going on organizationally. I think it's complicated and it requires just a lot of intuition and about human behavior. So I don't know if that really answers your question. I mean, there's not a list of things that they're necessarily looking at. Communities do, in order to do a project, every single partner that we work with has communities sign, and every single household signs an agreement that says, here's what the community is going to do, and here's what the partner is going to do. So it's all very clear and laid out. And the times that I've seen projects really fall apart are when communities refuse to sign that agreement. So, I mean, that's the final red flag. Do we have time for more? That's it? All right. Yes. There's a sign-up sheet if you're interested in getting more involved. There's a UW club that's forming, and there's a yellow sign-up sheet somewhere. Right outside. I knew I would forget. Thank you.